Welcome back to another episode of La Pausa Pod, where today myself and Jamie will be discussing a couple of teams and managers who are obsessed with having the ball. Yes, we will be discussing the chaos at the Ceramica, where Barcelona led by two, then saw Villarreal score twice to level the game before halftime. Villarreal went ahead in the second half, and then Barcelona finally came back to win 4-3. Fair to say, that was a wild one, which we'll get into now in a minute. Then we're going to talk about Las Palmas, who bossed a lot of the game against Real Sociedad on Friday night. It ended nil-all, but plenty to discuss from that game and their start to the season, and some growing concerns around Real Sociedad's attack. But firstly, Jamie, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Earlier start today. We're going to record earlier on Tuesdays from now on, so hopefully you get the podcast quicker in your feed. But yeah, all good.
Yeah, so and with the Champions League coming up and things like that, we're going to try and get it out as close to the weekend as we can. So we'll probably be posting it on early on a Tuesday. But firstly, Jamie, before we get into Villarreal, Barcelona, Las Palmas and the rest, I want to read out a few stats for you. We're going to do a little bit of guess the player here. So he's averaging 78.41 touches per 90, which is ninth amongst midfielders in La Liga, 3.09 touches in the opponent's penalty area, 11th among midfielders in La Liga, 14.68 successful passes ending in the final third, 10th in La Liga, 35.54 passes in the opponent's half, 10th in La Liga. Can you guess what I'm talking about or where I'm going with this?
I'm not quite sure how I became the anti-Isco spokesman, but I'd say to that, first of all, I should say I'm very pleased Isco is in La Liga and actually playing football, but I kind of just think Pellegrini has given him such a platform that if he didn't take this opportunity and actually contribute, then it would be such an incredible shame. I mean, he was the player who had the most touches in the Betis team on Sunday night against Athletic, which I think just that stat alone shows what a platform Pellegrini has given him, the freedom he gets to play with, just a sense of being connected to the game and not having a coach who is being a taskmaster and saying, if you're not pressing or whatever, all the off-ball stuff, then you're not going to play. Like, this is a golden opportunity for Isco, so yeah. Although I don't quite agree with a third consecutive MVP award, I am generally happy, I have to say.
That was going to be my final clue. If you didn't get it with the other stats, my final clue was going to be he has won 3 MVP awards now in 3 games, and that man, of course, is Francisco Román Alarcón Suárez, otherwise known as Isco. But yeah, I'm just joking about the anti-Isco thing. I do understand where your reluctance to get on board fully yet is there, because we've been hurt before in the past with Isco and so much promise there, and just kind of feels like for the last few years he hasn't fulfilled it. I guess motivation's an issue there when you played at Real Madrid, which is the peak for any Spanish footballer, any footballer in the world really, and you've won everything you can possibly win. It's undeniably difficult to feel motivated then to maybe drop down a level and not fight for titles every year. But Isco, like you said, that the role he's been given now is basically Sergio Canales' role, and he's just moving around, pretty much given free license to move wherever he wants. And the when we talk about the defensive issue, being more connected to the game makes him feel more inclined to get involved in the defensive stuff because he feels attached to the game. And I think that we've seen that definitely in the last number of games against Athletic Club as well, on Sunday night. They did lose in the end, but Isco was very good. But we're going to be keeping an eye on Isco, and we really do hope that he continues that. And I do know that you've certainly got a soft spot for him. Like all lovely footballers and football teams, you've got a soft spot for them. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today. And talking about soft spots, Barcelona's defence, it felt like for a lot of the game on Sunday, Villarreal versus Barcelona. It ended 1.73 XG for Villarreal to 3.06 XG for Barcelona. So Barcelona almost doubled Villarreal's XG, but they conceded three goals. And for a lot of the game, they were just trading blows with each other. Villarreal dominated for the first maybe 10 minutes or so. Then Barcelona had their turn. They turned that into two goals. And then Villarreal flipped that. They started to dominate. What were your thoughts initially on the game in general?
Yeah, so it'd be fair to say attack won out in this game, as you might have guessed from the scoreline. And for Barcelona, it was quite a contrast from going from those first two games against Getafe and Cadiz, where it was attack v defence practically the entire game. And then in this one, it was both teams pretty much just trying to match up man for man in terms of stopping the opposition attacking players. And yeah, it just resulted in chaos for long spells. I mean, the first half, Barcelona went 2-0 up, but they could quite easily have been behind by then. Like you said, that first 10 minutes of the game was pretty much a disaster from Barca's perspective in terms of trying to get to grips with Villarreal. And it was Baena coming inside and Pedraza opening the pitch up out left, which it sounds like a simple simple tactical wrinkle to try and get to grips with. I mean, Barcelona do it with their left-sided midfielder coming inside, so it was pretty bizarre to see just the amount of problems that they had with that. And Barcelona did come back into it second half very strongly, and the stats reflect that. What was it here? I mean, second half, 68% possession, 2.1 XG to 0.2 for Villarreal. And Setien said after that, look, we're not a team who can defend in the same way that other teams do. We have to defend with the ball. So once Barcelona took that step on and Villarreal had lost that sense of control, then yeah, it was kind of one-way traffic.
I was watching the Las Palmas game, which we'll talk about now, but there are kind of similarities in how Las Palmas didn't want to press too high, and Munir was on the right where Lamine Yamal was playing, and Munir did a much better job of sitting back and protecting against that out ball to Munoz. And whereas Lamine Yamal was caught between stepping inside to cover Ramon Terraz, who was dropping, and Oriol Romeo was going to him as well. Cuenca was the left-sided centre-back, and Yamal was nowhere near enough to him to affect him. And he also wasn't anywhere near Pedraza. So we'll talk about Yamal's defensive off-the-ball game in just a bit. But ask you if Romeo stepping up, Baena dropping, the ball getting put out to the left to Pedraza, and then coming back inside where Pedraza was free and Romeo was 10 yards behind him chasing, it didn't make sense because Sergio Roberto had stepped inside to track Baena, but he was getting caught because then he had to go out to Pedraza. It didn't make sense to me because Barcelona were neither putting pressure on the pass out to Pedraza, nor were they solid at the back because they were getting sliced open. Is this an issue with the tactic, with the formation that they're playing, or is it an issue with understanding of the game from the players, or is it a physical thing?
Good question. I would say in the first half, I felt like Barcelona were trying to be aggressive and trying to push up onto those technical midfielders to stop them playing. But again, just a very simple action from Baena to vacate the left side and move across just gave them massive problems. And if there's anybody in that team who you want to stop receiving the ball between the lines, then it is Baena, because you don't get away with allowing the passes through to him, you know, a couple of times, because he just goes. We know what he's like. We've seen him at the under 21 Euros. Once he receives that ball in the half turn, he's gone, and he wants to do damage. He's not a typical Spanish midfielder in that sense. So, yeah, It was funny as well because Xavi was sat in the stands for this game up above, so he must have known this was happening very early on, and they didn't really correct it. I mean, there was a point where Romeo went over to the side, I'd probably say about halfway through the first half. I can't remember exactly, but I'm sure he was asking the coaches, what should we do with this? Because it's very obvious what's happening, and Bayern is not a guy we can allow to receive that ball inside. And then, like you said, Pedraza was the flip side of that. He basically had an express lane on the left side, and we'll talk about Yamal soon. Obviously, an incredible performance from a 16-year-old, but it wasn't without its flaws, which are understandable from a kid so young.
To Xavi's credit, I do understand the lack of when I talk about they weren't pressing. I felt like there wasn't enough intensity in their press. It felt like they were trying to get push forward a little bit, but they were also very cautious as to not get caught from behind, because obviously Sergio Roberto starting at right back, it looks like João Cancelo is, as they say, it's been about to fall, that's a domino that's about to fall in the transfer market. And on the other side then, Marcos Alonso, Alejandro Balde would normally play there, and he can get up and down the field a lot easier and quicker than Marcos Alonso. So I do understand Xavi being a little bit wary of that. But at the same time, to Pedraza's credit, his control was immense in this game. Just so good. So many of those balls out to the side and there was a couple that weren't perfect, but some of his control for Baena's goal, for Sorloth's goal, just a joy to watch, really. And so moving on to that's defensively, I get Oriol Romeo, I get what he brings, but in possession, and this is something that they changed, and I thought they looked a lot better, and this is something that Xavi is going to have to figure out, but Romeo and Frankie de Jong sitting at the base of midfield, where Frankie de Jong is basically directing this whole thing. Barcelona are one Frankie de Jong injury away from complete crisis, I feel like. He's directing everything, but they also have Romeo sitting there. Is this the purist on YouTube and on Twitter, we're going to retweet that video. He was talking about positional play and in his most recent video, and he's basically saying that the reason why Xavi can't get this team to play the way that he wants them to is because a lot of the players don't have that grounding in positional play. And Frankie de Jong is a player who is a little bit more off the cuff and who didn't obviously grow up in La Masia and things like that, like Romeo, like Busquets, players like that. Is Romeo and Frankie de Jong overkill? Would you not be better off having Frankie de Jong watching Baena and being able to match him physically? Because Baena is a really tricky customer. He is very direct. He is, I won't say strong, but he doesn't look like a powerful guy, but he is quite strong, direct runner. Put Frankie de Jong there and then let de Jong dictate it from there. He's not Busquets. He's never going to be Busquets. That's fine. But he doesn't need to be, because Romeo is playing in the Busquets role now, in quotation marks. But he's not directing play the way Busquets did, and he doesn't interpret space the way Busquets did, and he doesn't have the hierarchy in the team where the defenders look up and look for Romeo. They're looking for Frankie de Jong. Why not just play Frankie de Jong there?
I think in this specific case, Villarreal, I would imagine there's a certain level of hesitancy from Xavi in terms of protecting the team, because he knows he's got guys like Marcos Alonso, Sergio Roberto at right back. That is far from optimal. As we saw in the game, they're not defenders who can hold up in terms of individual performance. So I think he just felt a little bit safer in this case by having Romeo there. But I agree, he does feel like he's there more in function to help Frankie de Jong in terms of the more off-the-cuff stuff that you mentioned. more so than being a player through, you know, in which Barcelona actually circulate the ball effectively. And I guess, I would imagine long term, Barcelona want to circle back to the 4-3-3 eventually. And I feel like Xavi is, he just doesn't feel quite compelled to take that step yet, because it would, like he said after the game, Frenkie de Jong, oh, there was a journalist who asked him, Frenkie de Jong, you know, fantastic performance today. And he said, no, not just today, you know, for many, many months now, he's been at this level. But again, if you then tinker with that position and play him in the Busquets role, in inverted commas, as you mentioned, does it then chip away from his impact overall in terms of affecting the game and taking that responsibility? I'm not sure. I mean, I would like to see the 4-3-3 come back, especially with Cancelo coming in, as we expect, because I feel like Barcelona need that balance across left and right again. And you could argue the best football they've played has come in that 4-3-3 at times. So, yeah, I guess it's in the front of Xavi's mind, but for now, I think he's playing it a little bit safe by having Romeo as a featured piece in this team.
That's a fair comment as well about Frenkie de Jong feeling the burden of playing the Busquets role, along with all of the creation he creates with his dribbling, and then you get caught because he does go forward a lot more than Busquets ever would or Romeo ever would. So you do have to have license. You do have to stay in that position. You have to be a lot more positionally. What's the word I'm looking for? You have to be more positionally
disciplined.
Thank you, Jamie. More disciplined defensively. And I think Frank, that probably would take the essence of Frankie. It would take his essence away from him. So I get that. But I just guess, I think it's just like, I'm just looking for a little bit of respect here for Frenkie de Jong, please. He's 26 now. He's at the peak of his powers. And it just feels like Barcelona, even trying to sell him a couple of years ago, and I know that he was a player who would have got a lot of money on the market when they needed it, and it wasn't necessarily a decision based solely on football, but it just feels like, are we appreciating him here? Are Barcelona appreciating him for what he does? And like I said, I think that they're one Frenkie injury away from having a serious, serious problem on their hands. And so Cancelo's about to fall, as I said. That's right back, you would imagine, sorted. Left back, Alejandro Balde comes in. He fixes a large share of the issues that Barcelona had. So you've got your 4-3-3 there in terms of your two fullbacks. And then going back to the idea about positional play and discipline and knowing where players are moving at different times, I don't know if Gabby is a genius or whether he's just completely winging it every single time. Because he started on the left here, which I think Ferran Torres has probably done enough now to merit a start in that position, given what he's done with his minutes, and he's had a really rough time since he joined Barcelona. We wondered if he'd ever get to where we thought he would get. So in a 4-3-3 then, him on the left, Ferran on the left, Balde as the left fullback, and Gabby either playing in the midfield, because I think he's better arriving rather than starting on the left and coming inside. Like, is Gabby, he's everywhere, but also didn't really affect the game at all on Sunday night. So he even kept Sorloth on side for his goal, when he should have been stepped out and gone at that stage, I think. And I just wonder, I just look at him and it just all feels very chaotic with him. And I don't know whether that's part of the plan or whether it's actually a bug in the system.
Yeah, there are games where you watch Gavi and you kind of have to check the numbers after to see what was his actual involvement in play in terms of possession. Because, you know, there's many games where it doesn't feel like he's overly affecting what Barcelona do with the ball. we know he's brilliant out of possession, and he's a tremendous character for Xavi, which I think he loves. But again, Xavi is in a, I would say, a similar position to Ancelotti in the fact that he's got an abundance of starting level midfielders, I should say, and that he feels, in a way, there's got to be some sort of emphasis there. So if you did move back to the 4-3-3, you are closing the door on a couple of players who feel like they should be starting in this team. So it's I would say Gavi is probably the one who has it most difficult to really keep a hold of his place in this side. I'm not saying he's not contributing enough or whatever, but it feels like we said, Ferran Torres is a guy who's really knocking on the door now. I think it would be just for him to get an opportunity to start in this side in coming weeks. I think just in terms of maintaining harmony in the squad, when you see a guy who was clearly working super hard, like Torres is, and he's making a difference when he comes on. Like, I don't think we can say his goal in this game will be remembered in terms of cleanness of strike and poor goalkeeping. But again, he does affect the game when he comes on, and I think there comes a point where you have to reward a guy like that when you see that, because those are the types of standards you want to build from the players who aren't playing. So yeah, there's not an overbooking of midfielders, but there's a lot of midfielders who want to play in this side. And now Cancelo is back. If there does start to be leanings back towards the 4-3-3, then those positions are going to be even harder to access for some as well.
I'll tell you, here's a Ferran Torres number 9 and Robert Lewandowski on the bench. How about that? That's we might see that one down the line, but we'll, Lewandowski is in a kind of a strange place at the moment here, I think. And it was a difficult game for Gabby even, because he was coming up against one of the podcast favorite right backs in Juan Foyt, and he had 18 duels in the game Gabby had, and he only won 4 of them, and that was because basically he had 18 and he won only 4 of them, and that was because, of course, he was up against Juan Foyt, who also had 18 duels and he won 10 of them. So Juan Foyt is just a physical, he's a specimen. Like, he's hard to get anything off, really. He was excellent in this game, and he had the most touches for any Villarreal player as well. So I think it was a tough matchup for Barcelona. Villarreal do cause you problems in possession. They're also very soft defensively, but they are going to cause problems for any team in possession, and we saw that on Sunday night. In possession, there are things that Barcelona probably could have done to help themselves a little bit. But one thing is, and I have to kind of go easy on Lamine Yamal, because he is just coming off his 16th birthday celebration. So I'm going to take it easy on him. But he probably needs to do a little bit more off the ball than what he did on Sunday night. It felt like he was getting caught in between pushing up, stepping inside, stepping outside, and maybe there is not clear enough instructions from Gabby. But and he spent a lot of the game in the first half kind of as a bystander, really, but at the same time in the second half he really stepped up and he was excellent in the end.
Yeah, that's probably the most impressive thing, was his best minutes in the game came at the point where Barcelona really needed it, and they needed that impetus to drive the game forward again. Like I said to you yesterday, I watched this game not live. I had to watch it back later on, and obviously I'd seen all the plaudits for Yamal on Twitter and X, sorry. And I was watching the first half, thinking, he's done okay. I think what I'd probably point towards from the first half was the fact of how many problems Barcelona had down that side defensively, more so than what he did in terms of individual impact. But then the second half came and he was just absolutely electric. To take such responsibility at his age in a delicate moment for Barcelona was incredible. And his impact didn't really show up in the numbers in terms of chances created and things like that, but he was generating massive amounts of danger. And those two shots that came back off the post were, if they'd have gone in, like, can you even imagine, the symbolism of that for a 16-year-old, like, individually dragging Barcelona out of the mire? He just looks like a senior professional player already. I know he's 16 and you can see it in his body, but his mannerisms, the way he takes the ball, the threat he can generate off the dribble. And Xavi said it after, and he said it multiple times, it didn't sound like he was falling in love with Yamal's dribbling or his speed or whatever. He said it, he just makes the right decision 90% of the time. He's deciding well nearly all the time. And I think that's probably what has got him in the door this early, that the fact he's not compromising the team in possession, he's not giving the ball away sloppily, he's generating danger, and he's being quite efficient with the ball as well.
And that brings me on to, let's just talk about the player here, because what that says about Lamine Yamal also says a lot about Rafinha, the player who's at replacing. And you're obviously a Leeds United fan. Watch Rafinha under Bielsa when he broke onto the scene and became a world-class winger. But it was Dembele first, who it always felt like Barcelona want to get back on top in Europe. And it always felt like you couldn't build a Champions League competitive side with Dembele in it. His best moments were better than anyone's, or almost better than anyone's, but then it was so chaotic that it felt like Lamine Yamal at only 16, you already feel like there's some kind of, like, I think it's the decision making. 90% of the time you can be sure that he's going, what he's going to do with it, and then he sprinkles in those moments of magic. Whereas Dembele could go missing and do something wild, and Rafinha on the other side of that, I don't really think it's a decision making thing with him per se, but I just think it's kind of like the Frankie de Jong thing a little bit. I get the feeling that they're just not convinced by Rafinha. There's something that's just not convincing them about Rafinha, because, as I said, it was first Dembele who was ahead of him, and now it's 16-year-old Lamine Yamal. Rafinha's got to be looking at this going, I'm never going to get a proper chance here.
Yeah, well, Yamal's got this one, obviously, because Rafinha's still out at the moment. But again, like, can you imagine if Dembele was still here and Yamal had arrived like this as well? To have three left-footed right wingers would probably be the worst news for Rafinha in terms of opportunities. Mm. And yeah, obviously he's a player I've watched a lot of over the years, Rafinha. I always felt he was a player who excelled a little bit more in the chaos and in a Bielsa team, where it was, super dynamic end-to-end games where he had space to work in this team that they currently have now. Like you referenced with the video from The Purist, it's all quite positional, it's all quite static. There's not a great deal of rotation and opening up spaces and relationships down the side. So I think Rafinha is one of those players that finds it a little bit harder to go from like a standing start to generating actual danger in the way that Dembele does, or Dembele did, and Yamal can already do at 16 years old. He completed three take-ons in this game, which is, I believe, comfortably above Rafinha's per 90 average from last season. So again, Yamal looks like he has the advantage in terms of 1v1 dribbling stuff. So it's very early with Yamal. He's 16 years old, but yeah, hard not to be enthused by that display.
And there's a maturity about Yamal as well that I don't think Rafinha has. Rafinha got angry at Xavi a while ago, and there's a sense of anger in Rafinha, moodiness, I think, that, and he, we also saw that against Getafe, where they would have probably won that game 2 or 3 nil if he stays on the field. But he went and they knew this was coming, and he went and just elbowed the Getafe player and got himself sent off. And it just, they knew that this was coming, what Getafe were going to do. And I think Rafinha just needed to, yeah, it was very an immature thing from an experienced player. But yeah, that's Barcelona, and we're going to be talking about them more during the season, because obviously they've got Champions League coming up. And Xavi, a lot of his, how he's perceived and how history judges him is going to be based on what he did in Europe. And I mean, the economic restrictions alone mean that he's fighting an uphill battle, and especially against the teams that they're going to have to beat. And I just, based off that display against Villarreal, I just can't see them making a dent in Europe here at all this season. But we'll move on to another team now, who are managed by a former Barcelona B manager, García Pimienta. Las Palmas have drew 0-0 with Real Sociedad, and they dominated a lot of the game. And a lot of the positional play principles are what we were talking about there, and what the purists talked about in that video. And I think Real Sociedad, we were talking about this yesterday, they got a bit of a fright, or not a fright, but they got a bit of a surprise as to how good and how brave Las Palmas were on the ball.
Yeah, we said it in the season preview for Las Palmas. This is a team who, if you've not seen them, one day you're going to turn on the telly and give them a go, and you'll be surprised by just how good they are technically and what they can do with possession. And this first half was really quite special. I know it didn't result in any goals, but to control a Champions League level team at both ends, so moving them around with the ball and then really disrupting their build-up at the same time, I think was really impressive for García Pimienta. Yeah, I think the most striking thing from this game, first half especially, was just that difference in quality on the ball and bravery as well. To watch guys like Mika Marmol, Kirian Rodriguez, there's just an incredible level of confidence and willingness to take the ball in difficult situations. I mean, we saw Real Sociedad, what they did to Girona on match day one, in terms of how they disrupted that build-up and just went incredibly man-to-man with the marking. They're a very difficult team to play through, but there was just no shortage of confidence from Las Palmas. And yeah, to contrast that with when Real Sociedad got on the ball, I just didn't feel like there was the same level of willingness to take the ball from Zubimendi, Marino, Bryce Mendes. You know, they're all international players, but again, when Las Palmas applied the pressure, they just really couldn't work their way around it in the same way that Las Palmas could to them. So it was, you know, this game ended 0-0. It was pretty balanced in terms of chances overall, but I think for the process for Las Palmas, it was a really good game.
Las Palmas have played 3 games now. They've drawn 2 and lost 1. Goals is probably going to be an issue for them. We'll talk about that now in a minute. But this has been a conscious effort to improve the technical ability in the squad. So they got promoted, obviously, from the Segunda last season. And most teams are thinking, once they get promoted, and they were a little bit of an anachronism in the Segunda, in that they had a very, very distinct style of play. We've got Andorra down there now, and Las Palmas were there last year. But it's not common to see that in the Segunda. It's usually very, just like, very kind of meat and gravy kind of styles and tactics. But Las Palmas kind of broke the mold in terms of that. And normally teams that come up from the Segunda do go and try to solidify their defense. But instead of going and trying to buy players who would make them more solid defensively, they've gone and leaned all the way into the possession-based stuff. So they went and got Mika Marmol, the standout central defender in the Segunda last season. Barcelona player from the academy, and he led the team in touches with 72, along with Alex Suarez, his centre back partner. And sort of they bought Mika Marmol. They had Kieran Rodriguez. They've got Jonathan Vieira. So that's three on each line of the field, the defense, midfield, and then just attacking midfield. You've got three of the most technically proficient players in La Liga at their position, and which is saying something, given the fact that Las Palmas were pretty much dead cert, like everyone had them guaranteed to go down. They haven't gotten the results yet, but they do play with that kind of style. Like Kieran Rodriguez has 261 touches so far, which is fifth in the league, which just goes, and this is for a relegation candidate here. Jonathan Vieira has 113 passes in the opposition half, which is seventh in the league. And they have, Mika Marmol, he's only played 172 minutes, but he's 88.4 touches per 90, which ranks him among the top five as well. Just incredible technical proficiency on the ball. And then another player who I wanted to point out, who I think has improved them, and right back was an issue for them last season, Julian Araujo, another Barcelona player. He's come in, and I thought he was excellent against Real Sociedad. His versatility is remarkable in that he can step into a back three and play there. He can play out wide, no problem. He's comfortable overlapping, underlapping, and then he's also comfortable stepping inside and inverting as a fullback. And I think that just gives them options. So while we're saying there's a confidence about them, there is absolutely, which is instilled from Garcia Pimienta. They know what he wants, and they're going to do it, and they know they're not going to be chastised for trying to play the ball into tight spaces. But that confidence also comes from the fact that they know that they're really, really good.
Yeah, I think, as well, from watching this game, especially, and having watched Las Palmas throughout last season, I think there will be an element from Garcia Pimienta where he's actually quite glad that teams are stepping onto them now, because last season was not easy by any means. They were playing against deep blocks practically every week. Especially at home, it was really hard to get that rhythm of play going and to generate chances. So, and it was something that I remember from Michel at Girona in Segunda as well. There were many times where I watched them and I listened to him after games, and he seemed at a loss as to how they could actually crack the code of playing against deep blocks every week in Segunda. So you see Girona now where they've got to. That's not to say Las Palmas are going to get there as well, but yeah, I think there comes a point where even though you're playing against these top sides now, the fact that they give you more space to work with and they actually step onto you, so you can actually eliminate them from the game if you can play around them, which is obviously what they're trying to do. I think this was a game where we saw it, that Las Palmas are not afraid by teams stepping onto them. I think to an extent that they're actually quite pleased about it.
Speaking about, this is a Champions League side that they're playing against. Real Sociedad are no joke. Imanol Alguacil is no joke. And in the first half, I'm just going to read out some of the stats. So Las Palmas, 0.79 expected goals to Real Sociedad, 0.03. Yes, do not adjust your microphones, folks. I said 0.03 XG in the first half. They had one shot, none on target. And they had 41.9% possession, Real Sociedad did. That first half, Garcia Pimienta will be delighted with that. That's a great point for them. And they still haven't gotten 3 points on the board yet. But yeah, he'll be absolutely delighted with that. So we'll move on now then to speak about an issue that, well, Las Palmas will be absolutely delighted with that. Real Sociedad have to be looking at that going, how did that just happen to us? And how do they fix that? Obviously, they're incredible defensively. They're fourth with the XG against. They've conceded the fourth fewest expected goals with 2.9 this season in La Liga. But they're 18th in expected goals themselves. And this is another game where they struggled massively in attack. They did improve, I thought, with Oyarzabal, who we spoke about on the pod, and when Sadiq came on. But I don't know whether that was just out of pure they had to do something or what it was. And Las Palmas probably got started to get a little bit tired. But what are your initial thoughts on Real Sociedad's start to the season? Where are the issues?
A bit confused, really. They're a team, I've said it from the start, I've picked them to be fourth again this season. I think they are the best team in La Liga outside of the big three that we know of. But it has been an underwhelming start. I think to take the lead to Girona and Celta Vigo and not take 3 points in either of those is pretty concerning. And then they came here and they had the same problems to an extent, I would say, in terms of one, keeping the ball, and then secondly, actually being effective with it. And I've seen an interview that Mikel Merino has done, not this morning, I think it's been posted this morning, with La Media Inglesa, where he's talking about the fact that we all said at the time that David Silva retiring was a big blow, terrible news, but he said until sort of two or three weeks had passed and they actually started to play without him, he didn't realise the extent of the problem at all. And it was interesting that he said in terms of his role as well, so Mirino and Bryce Mendes, the two players that play ahead of Zubimendi, to not have Silva there as a player who is constantly providing passing options and a player who you felt that you could always give the ball to and he'd protect it, he wouldn't give it up, has been a real shock to them when they've actually got on the pitch. So it's simplistic to put this down to David Silva. I think we could all make that point, but yeah, maybe we haven't made it quite enough in terms of how it actually translates on the pitch for them. So it's been a slow start in an attacking sense, and there have been signs that they're not moving the ball quite effectively. So maybe solutions are going to come from outside, like you said, Sadiq, Kieran Tierney, Arsene Zakarian, a player I admittedly don't know any about, but who has arrived as quite a marquee signing for them. So you could probably say the good news for now is that they're still a very difficult team to beat. So even without being fluent, you know, the base is still very much intact. But if they are going to be the fourth best team in Spain again, the attacking stuff has got to pick up pretty quickly.
Yeah, and maybe they will have to give up something, a little, kind of give a little bit defensively in order to improve in their attack. And I do think Kieran Tierney will definitely help that. Traore has helped on the right-hand side for sure. Mm. And I think maybe, obviously, the loss of David Silva would hurt any team, but they have a player who ideally could replace him in Kubo. Maybe he needs to be given a little bit more freedom to link, to drift inside and just play in a freer role. And because he had a lot of defensive responsibility against Las Palmas, watching Sandro Ramirez, and with Traore stepping up a little bit, Kubo had to be even more conscious and has to be more conscious now. But we spoke about how Real Sociedad needed to get more from their fullbacks, and they're doing that obviously with Traore and Tierney now, a pretty decent, a really good actually fullback duo, and they're going to be asking for more from them, which will obviously help Mikel Oyarzabal too, and that will then create more combinations for Bryce and Mikel Merino, and it just seems to help the overall symmetry of the team, and it feels like it helps to in terms of where they're going to be able to get overloads and more people involved. Because at times I was looking at I watched the games back to back. I watched them live, but then I watched them back over again. So I watched Barcelona and then I watched Villarreal. Sorry, I watched Barcelona and then I watched Las Palmas game. And I was looking at Baena compared to Bryce Mendes, two players who play in kind of similar areas of the field and who like to do similar things, but both very different players at the same time. And Bryce Mendes, it feels like exactly what Mikel Merino says. He's missing David Silva because he doesn't create as many connections with the players around him. I think starting Umar Sadiq is going to help with that. And I think possibly, as you said, Arsene Zakarian, he could help, but haven't seen anything from him. Let's see. And also a player maybe like Andre Silva, who's injured now and we don't know when he's going to be back, but they do have options here to improve. Whether or not Imanol Alguacil is willing and ready to maybe give up a little bit of that defensive solidity in order to push more players forward and create more combinations and to test opponents' backlines will remain to be seen. And it is one way of them improving this problem they have at the moment.
Yeah, we should say, I think even though Real Sociedad have been a little bit back from their usual level this season, you know, the signing of Hamari Traore, I think, has been very good. We said we both liked him in pre-season, and I think he's one who has genuinely played well across every game so far. So we said as far back as last season that fullback on both sides was a necessity for this team, and they've solved both of those in a big way. So maybe when Tierney does enter this team, as we expect he will, that we will see quite a big change just from having a bit more at fullback on both sides.
And maybe one reason why Real Sociedad will finish forward is not any particular quality they have, rather a lack of quality. From Villarreal look like a team who, this could go either way here for Setien, which always feels like that with Setien and Villarreal.
Yeah.
Real Betis look quite good, but again, some of their frailties in terms of staying the distance, whether or not they can keep up. Athletic Bilbao, the same kind of maybe lacking a little bit of quality to finish fourth. Sevilla, nowhere near their level at the moment. So yeah, Real Sociedad just need to kind of hang in there now and improve slightly attacking sense, and they should be fine, or they could be fine. But yeah, we'll see. Although Girona, I haven't even mentioned Girona there, but listen, we'll save that for another pod.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. Isco is dragging Betis to fourth single-handedly. 38 MVPs.
Fourth? You mean second? Yeah. He's going to win 38 MVPs, yeah, and they're going to finish ninth. But, yeah, plenty of teams. Yeah, Girona, really exciting. Atletico Madrid obviously beat Rayo Vallecano 7-0 last night. Haven't had a chance to watch that one back, but I remember when they won the league in the year they won it, the year of the coronavirus, they, with Luis Suarez, they beat Granada 6-1 at home in the first game of the season, and it was just a really competent performance. That victory over Rayo Vallecano on last night, Monday, is another sign of this Atletico Madrid team with all their pieces in place. Molina, Rodrigo De Paul, Griezmann, Depay seems to be firing now, and with Koke yet to come back, and maybe one or two additions to come in if Joe Felix does eventually go, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they could really, really test Real Madrid here, who are missing Vinicius now for a number of weeks. And they're probably a striker light at the moment to take advantage. But let's see. I think it's going to be an interesting season in La Liga regardless.
Yeah, obviously they play Real Madrid in the not too distant future, so that's going to be an interesting first test. Last night was really impressive. I saw bits of it, enough to know the damage that Atletico were doing. And we said it after the Betis game. I don't think this was a game for individuals by any means, but having Molina back at right wing back and providing that balance between both sides again is absolutely massive for Atletico. So we saw that this setup last season was basically the best team in La Liga in the second half of the season. So when they've got those pieces all in place, then I don't see why they wouldn't be fighting for the title or close to doing so. If Barca or Madrid happens to have problems.
Yeah, but some of those cracks starting to appear in Rayo's team that we spoke about at the start of the season, but we'll hold our judgment on that as well. But we've obviously got one more round of fixtures and we'll be back next week, but then we've got an international break and we might do a Q&A for that podcast instead of taking a week off or discussing anything else. So yeah, we'll do a Q&A for that week, and yeah, we'll leave it there for this episode of the podcast, but we'll see you next Tuesday as early as we possibly can get it out next week.